hard set of, we can be curious about others, people can be curious about us. Let's just explore, like each other, what each other's about, and build connections and relationships. I think that's at the heart of it.
Thank you. That's a lovely note to end on.
Well, lovely.
That was my conversation with professional basketball player and two-time Olympian Catherine Plouffe, who lives in Edmonton, Alberta. This has been the RVF Franco Podcast 2026. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks to Catherine for that. Now into our next segment. This is a clip from a larger conversation about the Cowichan Tribe's Richmond land claims decision. But this section we're going to play here, it's about 5-6 minutes long, focuses specifically in on what is Aboriginal title. And it's kind of a concept that underlies a lot of the issues we're hearing around Aboriginal rights these days. So I wanted to replay it today. And this is a conversation with UVic Professor of Law, Dr. Esther Van Wagner. Because you've talked about how it coexists with fee simpler private property rights. So there's Aboriginal title here. There's the Crown lands, which is a kind of ownership. There's the provinces and the federal government sort of sovereignty over this territory we call British Columbia and Canada. How do those things relate?
Sure. I mean, I'm, you know, I'm teaching property right now. I'll sort of teach this for the whole year. So this will be a very simplified mini version of, but the, there's different ways of recognizing property relations. So the Crown has certain kinds of lawmaking power with respect to land that flows from the Constitution, and the province and the federal government have that for their respective Crown lands. And then there's also ownership of rights of the Crown for their respective lands and the ability to make certain decisions by virtue of that ownership. And in the case of the province, that's recognized by Section 109 of the Constitution. And in that section, it says subject to any other interests. And it's clear from the case law that Aboriginal title is one of those interests that the provincial crown land holding and powers associated with are subject to. So even the crown doesn't have that kind of unlimited property right. All of the property rights outside of the protected Section 35 Aboriginal title rights in the Canadian legal system are derived of the crown. So I just taught my property students about this. We exist in an estate system that's derived from the tenurial system. And so we still, in Canada, hold our property of the Crown. There's no absolute ownership in our system. The Crown has an underlying title, and we get a kind of what we refer to it as in property law as a slice of time in the land. And fee simple represents one of the largest sets of rights that we associate with an estate in land. But it's always of the Crown. And as this decision makes clear, those interests are not absolute. We decide to limit them in a bunch of different ways, including municipal zoning, including environmental regulations. And Aboriginal title, while it is the common law's way of understanding the Indigenous interests in land rooted in pre-existing societies being here, governing those places, having relationships with those places, it is unique because it's not derived from the Crown like those other interests. So its content, what is being recognized there, is not simply an Indigenous version of a fee simple. It's unique, and it is sourced in a very different way. And that goes into some of what was decided in the decision, that the recognition of Aboriginal title is not subject to things like the Land Titles Act, because it's not a crown-derived interest. So it is regulated and limited, while not absolute. The limitations that apply to it are unique from the limitations that apply to fee simple.
So that's a little clip from our interview with Dr. Esther Van Wagner. It's part of a whole interview that digs more deeply into that Cowichan Tribes case. You can find the whole interview on our SoundCloud. Just search for SoundCloud, CJSF Radio, and you will be able to track it down and pick up the whole thing. If you want to listen specifically to that section, you can find it. Starts at about 10:50 in the audio track. All right, now we're going to head off to our regular segment, Gardening with Embark.
Good morning and welcome to
Gardening with Embark. Joining me in the studio, as he does every week, Pablo Vimas from Embark Sustainability, our resident gardens expert.
Hi, good morning.
And we're definitely getting some spring weather here.
Yes. Finally, the sun is shiny, temperatures are warming up. Still, the rains are hanging around, but I hope the coming weeks less rain and we can be in the garden more often.
Great, and we are in week
10. Yes.
So we're thinking about the year ahead, and we talked a bit about last week about thinking farther ahead. But there's more to deciding on what you're going to do in your garden than just what you're going to plant, but how you're going to plant.
Yes. So let's start defining what is a garden. Mm-hmm. Okay, so a garden is the cultivation of land. In other words, is a man-made ecosystem or human-made ecosystem. And we can have two perspectives. One perspective is from the human perspective, mm-hmm. that we create that space. And there is other perspective from nature. Mm-hmm. So how nature sees the garden is something that is initiated by humans, given a purpose and a direction by humans, and maintain it with the help of humans.
Yeah.
So we gardeners should be present in all these three steps in order to consider a garden.
Right.
Sometimes we are so eager at the beginning when we are beginning gardeners, we go plant and later we realize that there is lots of maintenance to do and suddenly we fade out from the garden.
Right.
And the garden is not anymore a garden because there is no human interaction, there's no maintaining. So that turns into a wild spot.
Yeah.
Okay, which usually fellow gardeners say, well, that spot is full of weeds, it's forgotten. Yeah. So these are two perspectives now. Then most of the time when you ask people, say, what are you gardening or what is your garden? And they say, I'm doing organic gardening, which means is no using pesticides, helping nature to grow in that space, being diverse, and bringing the life into the soil.
Right.
So organic means is a combination of different factors which we want to bring life into the soil, have lots of plants, not just one crop, which we tend to use that, just garlic and we forget, or just kale. No. So we need more than one crop to make it organic. Yeah. And bring lots of organic matter so the living things in the soil grow and develop further. So now, when we say I'm doing organic gardening, that sends us to further because there are different philosophies that we, over the years, it has been developed. One of them is biodynamics.
Yeah.
That was that word was coined in 1925, so almost 100 years ago. And it has been going strong. The principle of biodynamics is that energy flows through Earth. So we now have to have a concept what I'm trying to do. So if energy flows through Earth, through the plants, through our cells, through the system, so you get that concept. Biodynamics very much follows and growing or cultivating by the moon cycle. So you will cultivate and all your gardening practices will be following the moon cycle because that is the energy.
Right.
Then we have permaculture. That was in 1971, was coined by two researchers in Australia. They decided, look, the forest maintains itself, constantly, permanently? Can we do in that forest structure, that forest, how they is organized into the farm?
Mm-hmm.
And so that we have, since now permaculture has become kind of a, at origin that was a permanent agriculture,
mm-hmm.
and now it has come into permanent culture. So it's these three principles of care for the people, care for the land, and fair share that we hear all over the place,
mm-hmm.
have our origins on permaculture.
Right.
And so these are the three core principles. And besides, in addition to that, you have like 15 different ways actions that complement permaculture. For one of those is storing energy.
Yeah.
So it is collecting water and doing some canning and pickling your produce.
Mm-hmm.
So that is also conserving energy because all the fruits,
right.
it's solar energy transforming those beautiful sugars in our fruits.
Yeah.
And then if we cannot eat all at once, we can, we pickle, we dry. So that is conserving energy.
Yeah.
And there is other more principles like recycle, so everything that goes into the ground tends
right,
to
so,
the
so composting and turning things back into the garden.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So all that. So now you will say, "Oh, organic as well includes that."
Yes.
And then in 1981 was the regenerative word was coined,
yeah.
and this mainly focused on bringing life to the soil.
Yeah.
So conventional agriculture, which was using lots of pesticides, lots of fertilizers, chemical fertilizers, destroyed the living of the soil. The
right, and then you'd have to replace it with other yes. material to keep the soil working.
Yeah, so what happened is the bacteria, fungi, and invertebrates died because of so much chemicals. But now with the regenerative principle is we need to bring more organic matter and create an environment for those bacteria, fungi, invertebrates to mm-hmm. bloom and continue flourishing, and that has an effect on the soil. And a healthy soil produce healthy plants.
Yeah.
And so that is now the concept that we have working lately is regenerative, being regenerative, stop using pesticides, which again goes back to being organic.
Yeah.
So those are the three principles that when we gardeners are sitting down, we like say, okay, I do organic, but which of these principles of actions from these philosophies
mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to use?
Right.
Yeah. So here in our, it's a few campus, everybody asks me, are we doing permaculture? Like, not really, because we use small boxes.
Right.
And well, the other thing is permaculture very much works with guilds. We, in gardening, we are very familiar with companion planting.
Yeah.
Okay, so companion plantings, they're annuals, together planting potatoes with some other
plants that work together.
Yeah, plants that grow
really
together.
Well.
Yes, yeah. But in permaculture, we talk about guilds.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you have an apple, and the apple is surrounded by annuals or by other plants. So that's why we call the guilds.
Right.
As well, with permaculture, you have a design, which is the how the plants are grouped together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we don't do, we do little bits like composting.
Yeah.
We do collecting the rainwater, but once we have lots of produce, what we do is just share for everyone to the produce can be consumed fresh. Will be nice to if we have a lot of tomatoes and do some canning and develop all those skills or homesteading skills, which will be awesome. So when you are now is the time that we gardeners are starting to think, okay, I'm going to plant these crops and I should in my mind which of these approaches I'm going to use, and then is how I'm going to put or distribute my crops into mm-hmm. the ground.
Right.
Yeah, so then we have like, which is common, is single rows, mm-hmm. is what we saw see in the farms.
Yeah.
So a long row of strawberries, a long row of carrots.
Right.
Or we go with another approach, which is in spots. So you put like a square foot gardening in one square foot, 12 inches by 12 inches, you put 16 carrots.
Right.
That's it. No more.
Yeah.
16 carrots, 5 lettuces, 9 beets. There is a huge information about square foot gardening. And the other way we can do gardening is just what nature does. Nature, what does it just throw the seeds into the air, and wherever they fall, they grow. So right. That we I call wild planting.
Yeah.
So you just can take a have your seeds, make a mix, and then you just throw it, the sprinkle over your garden bed, and see how you grow. So there are different ways. Mm-hmm. With these different approaches or planting your or distributing your crops is how dense and intensive you are planning to grow your garden.
Yeah. So I was going to say, with these different approaches, is there a difference with how much work you need to do on the maintenance of the garden?
Yes.
It seems like when it's all organized and you know where everything is, that might be a little simpler.
Indeed, it's simpler. And for instance, if you have a single row, you will have empty space in between the rows, which is nice environment for weeds or to grow. So it's lots of weeding.
Yep.
And then we have the tight space, like the square foot gardening, which you have so many crops, so many plants in one square, there is little space for weeds to grow, so less work. Yeah. But square foot gardening requires that you are harvesting and planting.
Right.
So
you got to really be on top of
it. Be on top of that, yeah. So two squares, one next to each other, have two different crops. So in our garden bed, we have 16 square feet, so we can grow 16 crops at once.
Mm-hmm.
And so square foot gardening as well allows us to plan in advance how much food we are going to grow. As I mentioned, 16 carrots.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you go to the supermarket, a bunch of carrots is around 3 carrots per bunch. Yeah. Now you have 16. So you have quite a bit of five bunches of carrots. How often, how much carrots you use, mm-hmm. you eat a week. So you're thinking, and you remember that all those carrots are coming at the same time.
Right.
And then you can have five head of lettuces. How many lettuces a week you eat? So one, two.
It doesn't sound like much, but when you actually break it down this way, it's actually quite a lot.
Yeah.
Like if we're an individual household to be using.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that square foot garden is a nice approach because we say, okay, I'm going to plant three squares of this crop and will be more than enough.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's more. And when with the wild planting, that is more difficult because now you have weeds in between your crops.
Yeah.
So you have to be very good in identifying your weeds. Otherwise, you might be eating weeds because you come and cut your baby greens and suddenly weeds could be there. So So it's all different approach, how much time you have. I always advise come at least once a week to visit your garden, one a week, because the garden constantly is dynamic, and so it constantly is changing. And when you arrive, if you miss 2 weeks, you don't know what happened with the garden.
So there's a lot more to this than we have time to talk about here. Where can people find out? There must be lots of resources online where you can read a bit more about this.
Yeah, absolutely. There is the Regenerative Society. You can Google it. There is the Square Foot Garden Society or Foundation. Permaculture. You just type permaculture and you have lots of good resources. And learn a bit more about each of those systems and see how which system fits to your beliefs and the way of life as well.
Mm-hmm.
That is how we bring our life to the garden, and the garden as well teaches us. They teach us to be patient because we cannot rush the garden. Sometimes nothing works as we want, so we have to be resilient.
Yeah.
So resilience and patience is one of the things that the garden teaches us.
Excellent. Well, it's a lot to think about, and we have some homework for folks to do to look into this more and think
That's
about
right. yep.
how it fits their life and their garden and how they want to approach it. Thanks so much, Pablo.
It was a pleasure to be here today.
Great. We'll be talking more about ideas and things you need to be thinking about for your gardening year ahead in the coming weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not very long before we're going to be putting our seedlings in the ground either.
The last time that we expect frost here in Metro Vancouver is March the 28th, which is just 2 weeks away.
Great. Well, right. Thanks so much, Pablo. Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society and our weekly gardens expert. Tell us how to find out more about Embark.
Yeah, you can find out more about our events and what Embark does in our website, embarksustainability.org, or through our social channels at Embark Sustainability.
Great. Thanks so much, Pablo. We'll see you next week.
See you next week.
And Pablo will be back next week, indeed, with another edition of Gardening with Embark. Coming up in about 10 minutes here on CJSF is Democracy Now!, and they'll be digging deep into the current war in the Middle East, among other issues. Right now, though, it's time for Peter R.H., and you're going to talk about plastic.
A plastic, too, but I'm going to... So there's a YouTube posting, it's just about 2 weeks old, Confessions of a Former Climate Activist. So this is Lucy Biggs, mm-hmm. and she has, I'm looking at a picture she's showing of her and Greta Thunberg. And then she was very active like 10 years ago, for about 5 years in the climate activism. And then she came to question it. What was interesting also to me that she questions the concern about plastic. Like, it becomes like a dichotomy. It's like, mm-hmm. If I'm questioning the climate change, then maybe this plastic stuff is nonsense too. Now, what I think is a bit different between the two issues is that the question of plastic is pretty basic. Mm-hmm. It's a rather simple I don't think there's any, you cannot really have an argument that the concern about plastic does not exist. It was invented in 1909. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of plastic, like nylon stockings. I guess that isn't used very much nowadays, isn't it, Magnus?
Well, I think
is that pantyhose, nylon stockings?
Yeah. I mean, I think most... most pantyhose and stockings, unless they're silk stockings, yeah. are still probably some form of
spun. No, but that was it.
Plastic.
Yeah. They used to have something like that wasn't plastic. And like, I saw a movie from the early 30s where it was like stockings, but it wasn't nylon. But the charts in Wikipedia about plastic, they started in 1950, mm-hmm. even though plastic was sort of... some plastic products were introduced to the public in the 1939 New York World's Fair.
Yeah.
The World of Tomorrow, that's what they were doing. And then there was a comic book character that was called Plastic Man that came about 1941. But that was using the concept like plastic surgery. I used to think plastic surgery was where you inject the plastic into the face. But that it just means the original
meaning. There are kinds of plastic surgery that you do inject stuff.
No, but that,
anyway.
it's where you move the face.
Yeah.
We don't have that video.
Yes, the idea of something being plastic, which is moldable, malleable, which is, I guess, one of the things that plastic is kind of like.
Well, but anyway. when you're making something, that this is why it can be in so many shapes, because in its original form, I guess when it's very hot, I think that would be it, wouldn't it? You can mold it. So Plastic Man would be called Rubber Man. Or he's in the Fantastic Four has Reed Richards can stretch, but they kind of have lifted the concept from Plastic Man.
Yeah.
The problem is that so much is being produced, and there's a chart here in Wikipedia, and they start in 1950.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the collectible toys from the 40s, you'll notice they're tin. You know what I mean? You don't see plastic until like the 50s.
Yeah.
But it just skyrockets. It's got here close to zero. It is on 1 million metric tons. And it goes 1950 close to zero. Then it's 200 million metric tons in the year 2000. Interesting, in 1980, it's a bit less than 100. I guess it's worldwide. I guess in the developing world, there's progress, economic progress. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that plastic for medical devices that you couldn't really make previously has mm-hmm. been able to be made by it, but we have to stop having it as a throwaway item in a lot of things. Like I get razor blades, and like that little stem of it is plastic.
Yeah.
And I don't know. It's just that it's become so like a disposable item.
And one of the things about a lot, if not most, plastic products is of course one of the appeals of products is I think, or not plastic rather, is that it's relatively low cost to manufacture things versus other materials, right? So you can make cheap razor blades, disposable razor blades. You can make toys that are cheaper to build, I'm sure, than tin. You can make plastic bags. You can make plastic this, plastic that. It's all relatively inexpensive. And because it's inexpensive, it's, as you say, often disposable. And they're not necessarily meant to be durable products that you might hang on to for tens of years or whatever, because they're just there, like, for instance, that's a ceramic or your steel utensils or things like that.
Well, this is the problem, is that there is an aspect of plastic that it is a durable thing. That's the thing about it. And I think it's just because we have that's made out of plastic. That's a cheap piece of junk. But we kind of say, if it's made out of some other material, it's classy.
But it's interesting because one of the things plastic does over time, at least in the form of a usable product, is break down. The plastic degrades or becomes brittle or whatever. And so the product, you can't use them forever.
It breaks? That's what you're really saying.
Yeah, but even then, it exposure to sun, it gets brittle and it breaks, and right, that's just what it happens. But the other part of plastic is that the molecules and the little pieces.
Yeah.
Only break down to a degree, but on a certain level, they just never go away after that. One of the things they're finding in the ocean is, like, even in the deep ocean, they'll find small plastic parts. They find small plastic parts inside our bodies, and in wild animals and in the environment, and these little bits of microplastic. They break down to a point, but they don't entirely go away. It's not like, an organic matter where it breaks down and then is consumed by various natural forces and transformed into something else and returned into, into the life cycle of the world. They just sort of break and then they just hang there. And we're making more and more and more of this stuff that's just there and then breaking down and then landing in the environment and then not going away.
Well, it's funny, when there was still a Woodward's food floor at Oak Ridge, they actually changed from the paper bags to plastic because they said, we're using too much paper products. And now they've gone back, or they'd say, bring your own bag, please. But it's interesting, there was in the 80s, there was a concept, stop our usage of wood or paper.
Yeah.
By going to plastic bags, which was sort of interesting. And then it's now the opposite.
We're seeing a bit of a, where you can get like a grocery bag, it's going to be a paper bag.
But it was interesting in the 1980s. It wasn't seen, that would be a problem. I mean, it's sort of, we're coming now to realize it's a problem. Which is a separate problem from climate change or whatever. I mean,
well, it's an interesting thing. You're talking about back then, because it's like, why are we cutting down trees to make paper bags that we're just going to use once? Let's use plastic. And now it's like, we can't use plastic because it never goes away. So at least at least paper you can put it into the recycling and it will be turned into pulp and reused in some fashion or another.
Even if you don't recycle it, at least it doesn't. It'll blend into the ground or something.
Even on its own, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, I guess Lucy Biggs is sort of not part. She had a picture with her and Greta Thunberg there I was looking at. Anyway, I guess she's going to use a lot of plastic from now on, probably. I don't know.
Well, we'll have to dig another time into the idea of, what was the term you used, a reformed or a lapsed climate activist?
A confessions of a former climate activist. That was her.
Well, we only got 25 seconds left, so we don't have to. Well, we don't have the time to dig into what that means.
I was mainly talking about the plastic thing that she had. She doesn't see that as an issue. That was the main thrust of what I have to say today.
All right. Well, that's the show for today. Thank you for tuning in. This has been Speak Up with Magnus and Peter. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up right now.